All right. Okay, we are recording. Here we go. All right. So today we're going to transition from some of the philosophical personalities and background to the medieval time period. We sort of explored different trends in Islamic philosophical thinking, whether it be the Kalam, who took a more apologetic defensive stand vis-a-vis Islam, whether it be Neoplatonism, which was sort of a more mystically inclined monistic approach to all of existence and creation, whether it be what we recognize as roughly Maimonidean or Aristotelianism, and some of the different personalities associated with those different schools, as well as the move towards Sufism, which is an even more predominantly mystical approach, which is championed by Al-Ghazali, and then in turn has influences, as we'll see, in Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. So with that background in mind, we're going to now, and just being aware of sort of just the breadth of the educational opportunities that were taken advantage of and that were available to Jewish thinkers and even students at that time, to take a look at some Jewish personalities. Some of them a little bit less well known, some of them better known, some of them we'll just touch on, some of them in greater depth. The more famous ones we'll do in greater depth, as you might expect, as we go along. But we're going to start with a couple of lesser known, but really we'll move in chronological order. And you'll see that that in different ways there are points of intersection with a lot of what we've been talking about. And this time period will really ultimately, probably be in a few weeks' time, will really reach its crescendo with the Rambam, who really deserves a course in his own right. We'll probably, right, but we have a list that's too long of too many courses that have to be given. That's a little bit backlogged at this point. But the Rambam, we'll spend a considerable amount of time on the Rambam, certainly. And we'll go from there. So the first personality I want to introduce is one that's, again, a little bit less well-known. His name is Menachem Ibn Saruk, generally spelled in the English, which is had nothing to do with how his name was really spelled, but usually spelled S-A-R-U-Q, of course. It was in Iraq, the Q at the end without the U. Menachem Ibn Saruk. He lives 10th century, 920 to 970 roughly. Most of these personalities, we only have circa dates. We don't have precise dates. We have a general sense. His outstanding contribution was as a grammarian. And so you have a whole school of people who are deeply invested and passionate about grammar. Now that's interesting because where I come from, or where I grew up, that wasn't necessarily always the case. In fact, I've even, believe it or not, encountered students and scholars, frankly, who find grammar to be particularly bland, disinteresting, even. Right? Say the word? Boring. Yes. Right, so that's how many, not everyone, I know so there's some people that I love and that I embrace and that I make fun of regularly who absolutely love grammar and art. That's right. But at this time in history, those people are just really traditional because they understood that this was the way that things were in the Sephardic Jewish community at this time during the Golden Age of Spain. Ibn Saruk's great work is known as Machberet Menachem, the notebook of Menachem, literally, but really it's a dictionary of biblical words, of biblical roots. Interestingly enough, it's written in Hebrew, which seems like an afterthought, but is extremely important. Many of the works that were written at this time were, of course, written in Arabic or Judeo-Arabic, as they're currently called. Menachem decides, perhaps in a proto-Zionist vein, maybe because he just wants to elaborate the Hebrew language properly, and so what better way to do that? Is there any other way to do that than on the language itself? But because it's written in Hebrew, that means that it gets widespread circulation in Ashkenaz as well. Mm. If you're in Judeo-Arabic, then the French and the German Jews don't have any idea. They generally don't speak the language. However, if you write in Hebrew, so then it is not in the vernacular of any local community at that time, on the one hand. So it's only the scholars who will have access to it. That's one of the arguments for writing Judeo-Arabic, is because you're going to have a wider audience in Islamic lands. That being said, or Arab lands. That being said, because he writes it in Hebrew, it spreads through Ashkenaz, and Rashi in particular picks it up. Rashi, who lives later, right? Ibn Saruk is living 920, 970, Rashi from 1040 to 1105, but even though they don't overlap, Rashi, God bless Rashi, his access to Machberet Menachem that gave it enough time to then start to spread to Ashkenaz. It took some time for these things to get around. And Rashi quotes Machberet Menachem from time to time. If you take a look at Rashi's commentary in Chumash, he quotes Menachem Ibn Saruch. I wouldn't say all the time, but from time to time. It's not uncommon. He calls him the Machberet, which is kind of funny because Rashi, or even ironic, Rashi's known as the Kuntres, which is also sort of a stencil notebook of some sort that others would refer to Rashi, and Rashi in turn refers to Menachem as the author of the Machberet, or the Amar, right? Sometimes also, I think I'll often just say the Amar Menachem, like Stam Menachem in Rashi's commentary in Torah is Menachem Ibn Saruk, which I think is important also because what we see is that even though these societies were distinct, there's sometimes more overlap in communication than we tend to think. It's true that there wasn't necessarily a constant free flow of communication, but certainly there were certain things, especially when the language was right, that really did circulate, and there was sort of cross-pollination in that way. Menachem also has a very close relationship, someone we'll look at in a few minutes, a great statesman by the name of Chastai Ibn Shaprut. Ibn Shaprut lived roughly the same years as we'll get to in just a moment, or in a few minutes. And so he's well connected with people who are statesmen who can make sure that he has proper funding, which is very often, just like we have in our world, let's say an artist will be, right, or right, will be supported, will be financed by, right, by, you know, nowadays usually an organization or even an individual, right, the notion of a patron, right, as we had through at the time of the Renaissance, etc., when it comes to the arts. So here also, very often, in order for these great poets and thinkers and grammarians, etc., to succeed, they needed someone to fund them so that they could actually be scholars and spend their time publishing, as scholars like to do. So so he was well connected, and that was certainly helpful for him. He was also, as was the nature of grammar, if you had strong opinions about grammar in the day, get ready for a fight, because people weren't just letting you, you know, make your assertions about Hebrew roots and such. just like you know, do that with impunity. I mean, the stakes are very high. And so he actually gets into, this is actually really unfortunate, in all seriousness, is actually even a physical altercation that takes place on a Shabbat due to some of the vociferous objections to some of his grammatical theories. So if you think in any local community politics that you've ever seen in your life were impassioned, you should have seen the diktik wars back in the Golden Age. Now, in particular, the one who spoke out most strongly, even antagonistically, against the work, I don't think intended as anything personal, but as these sometimes go, unfortunately, things shade a little bit from attacks on substance to attacks on person, unfortunately. But the second person I'm going to look at, who in turn was exceedingly critical of Menachem, was Dunash ibn Labrat, born roughly the same time. Dunash, one of those unforgettable names, the Golden Age of Spain, born roughly in 920, passes in 990, so he outlives Menachem by roughly 20 years. He actually, interesting, also speaks his life story, his biography, speaks in a different sense, not Ashkenaz and Sfard, but speaks also in his own way to the overlap, to the connectivity between the different communities that we've been speaking about. He's born in Fez. He's born in Morocco. He actually spends time studying with Saadia, I believe in Baghdad, and then eventually he makes his way over to Spain. Again, these are organically connected communities in the sense that he's sort of following. He's at that point of inflection, of transition. Remember, Saadia lives from 882 to 942, so Dunash is 22 when Saadia Gaon passes away. So he has some time to learn with him. And again, this is that time of transition in the Sephardic community where you can spend time in Baghdad, you could spend time in Morocco, spend time in Spain, places like Cordoba, and you'll be sort of anchored in some of this, what are at that time, although some are being eclipsed by other communities, but those are all still major centers of the Sephardic community at that time. Dunash is best known to us probably as the author of one of our favorite songs that has probably earned as many tunes as any in our liturgy, which is Dvor Yikra, all the way to the Beach Boys and anything and everything in between. So that's Dvor Yikra is his. Interesting, just in Shemitah, just as an aside, Diror Yikra Levinim Bat, the notion of freedom associated with Shabbat is a really interesting theme. So even just the word that he opens with, I think is interesting as an aside, but that's perhaps his best known contribution. During his life, he was probably better known than even one song or poem, etc., as so many of them were authors of religious and secular poetry as well. But his scathing critiques of Menachem Ibn Saruk, for sure. And each one had followers, of course. They had Talmidim who ensured that their Rebbe was backed up. And unfortunately, again, at least on one occasion, it led to even some sort of physical confrontation. But he wasn't only critical of Menachem. Interestingly enough, he is critical of Rav Saadia Gaon as well. Now, this is interesting. He writes a book which is reverential, on the one hand, in certain respects, towards Saadia, who is his Rebbe. And yet the basic thrust of the work is 200 objections to the thought, various aspects of the thought of Saadia Gaon. 200 objections. That's the book. The book is Why My Rebbe Was Wrong in the Following 200 Regards. Now, this is a really interesting kind of Rebbe-Talmud relationship. Now, some might say this is disrespectful, that this is really not the way that a student should engage with his Rebbe. Clearly, Junash disagreed. I suspect that it's quite possible that maybe even Saadia himself would have disagreed with that perspective. Dunash was exceedingly respectful. He was his Rebbe, and he took him very seriously. But as part of his commitment to the joint journey toward finding truth, he felt that it was not only permissible or appropriate, but his responsibility to critique his Rebbe where need be, respectfully, but openly and honestly, and to forward a Jewish thinking mostly around grammatical issues, of course, what else, with regard to these different matters. Can you imagine a Talmud writing their Sefer is 200 critiques of my Rebbe's thought? Just that you'd have 200 is pretty good. Mirza Shem by my Talmud, I'll be so happy. You have no idea.
You say it was mainly on grammatical issues.
200? 200? I don't know. I don't know if I want to know the list. What? We'll see.
Grammatical issues?
That was a large piece of it, but the philosophical issues as well. But yeah, it was a range, pretty much. It's a catch-all. Anything? The subject was matters in which I'm critical of my Rebbe.
It goes with what you were saying last week about the culture of debate.
Oh, for sure.
And the value of public
discourse.
Discourse is better than I was going to say disagree. Right. You know, that right. We don't know quite, you know, what they were doing, and it's so different from what we do mm-hmm. now and how we do it mm-hmm. That it's, you know, it's putting our, you know, mm-hmm. looking at that, it just seems like it was embedded in part of the learning and part of the mm-hmm. richness of kind of propelling forward to the next thought mm-hmm. is that we're going to go through this here yeah. together, that's not like we're going to mm-hmm. like, yeah, that's why the respect
mm-hmm. but that seems, has to be the seems,
core. It seems like it's right. at the core of this.
That's right.
It's in the name of intellectual mm-hmm. honesty as opposed Understand. To insult.
Mm-hmm. I gotcha. Right, 100%. It's not a separate. It's not separate from that. It's from that sense of reverence. It's actually part of what that reverence really is all about, which is that we are engaged in this endeavor to work together to find truth, with a capital T. 100%. Which is pretty cool. And I'll cite in this context one of my favorite comments on Pirkei Avot, which is a much later personality in a very different culture with a very different philosophy in many other respects, which is a comment of Rav Chaim of Volozhin, the great founder of Yeshiva of the Yeshiva of Volozhin. His commentary on Pirkei Avot, known as the name right now, it'll come to me in a second. And in his Ruach Chaim's commentary there, and he comments on the Mishnah in the first chapter of Pirkei Avot, which tells us that Hevim et Abik ba'afar raglehem, which literally rendered means that one should sort of roll in the dust, as it were, of their feet, or to essentially to follow Talmid Chacham wherever they go and to learn from their example. So Rav Chaim Volozhin explains that's actually not the meaning of the term Heve Misabik, that if you take a look in Tanakh, biblically speaking, the term Lehit Abik actually refers to engaging in a fight. the physical encounter. The angelic personality, right? They wrestle until the evening. Says Rav Chaim of Volozhin, "Vehebe misabik ba'afar raglehen," means exactly this dialectic. He says it needs to be built upon afar raglehem. It needs to be built out of a sense. Start with reverence and respect and be done with the proper tone. But if a student is sitting in a class or just thinking through something that his Rebbe said, and the student is really qualified to develop his own opinion, I would add, he doesn't say this, but I would add her own opinion, same thing, and feels compelled that the Rebbe is incorrect. So the student not only is permitted, but has a responsibility to fight with the Rebbe, not in a way that's disrespectful, but to air an alternative possible view. And they discuss it together, and whoever's right wins. Right? And if the Rebbe is convinced that the student was correct, not only is he not upset at the student, but he feels enriched, right? And so he says that this dialectic of heve misabek, as long as it's rooted in ba'afar raglehem, he says that is the ultimate Rebbe-Talmud relationship. And to me, when I think about Dunash writing this respectful critique of his Rebbe, I think is really, it bears a resemblance to personality who lives some, you know, 850-some-odd years later, but I think it's really the same idea. Heve mitzabek, with an aleph, ba'afar raglehem. So I think it's very, very beautiful, moving comments. And beating it inside is just, it's beautiful. That's really, it's fabulous. Highly recommended reading. A beautiful piece. Okay, one of my favorites. Yeah. I'm developing like a top. I don't have a top 10. No, it's really hard.
That's cool.
It's top 20. I don't know. It's really hard to pin it down. I told the kids I did Parsha last week. Masoka the Nitziv, Rav Antal Tzvi of Berlin, the subsequent Rosh Hashiva of Volozhin, his introduction to his commentary on Chumash. He talks about why Sefer Bereshit is entitled Sefer HaYashar, the Book of the Straight. And what does that mean, the Book of the Straight? And he develops this idea that the Avot had the sense of sort of integrity or ethics, morality of Yashrut, that was the essential characteristic of the Avot, and that animated how they interacted with all human beings, and that's most obviously manifest in the way that Avram went to bat for the people of Sodom, who were not only not from his family or quote unquote Jewish, whatever that meant at the time, but they were, right? They were sinful. And yet he goes to bat. So I was telling them that Nitziv is a stunning piece. But if you enjoy too many pieces, it's hard to really refine. These are my top. So right now I'm working on my top 20, top 10, we'll see. But this Nefesh HaChayim, which I heard from Rabbi Rosenzweig in NYU, my teacher's there, is really one of my favorites. So that's Dunash. And next time you read Dvar Yikra, take a look at it. Look at the English and analyze it and see what we come up with. It'll be really interesting. I think I'll do that this Shabbat.
This is a question. Who was Ibn Shaprut? I don't think I'll
know. Ah, we're getting there. He's number four.
You mention him.
He's coming. He's coming right up. He's number four on my list. He's deep. He's right here.
What was the connection to Ibn Saruk? You mention him just.
They were both living in the same community. I don't know exactly the nature of the relationship, but I think Ibn Shaprut, as we'll see, was extremely well connected and was in charge of essentially much of the finances of the caliph at that time. Mm-hmm. And so he was able to ensure that some of these talented grammarians and thinkers were able to get some support.
He funded him. I think so.
I'm not sure the exact relationship, but that's my impression, is that Ibn Shaprut was instrumental in making sure that he was able to continue to engage in his scholarship. Okay. Third one, Yonah ibn Janach. I love these names, Janach. We generally spell J-A-N-A-C-H, and I love the Ibn's. Ibn Janach, again, roughly 990 to 1050. So he's born around the same time that Ibn Labrat is deceased. He passes away. I mention him now, even though I'm jumping a little bit out of chronological order, as you'll see, because I just wanted to sort of string together some of the grammarians in particular. Mm-hmm. Ibn Janach, his claim to fame is that he is the inventor, or the one who advocates convincingly for the notion that every single Hebrew verb necessarily has a, what we call a trilateral root, mm-hmm. a three letter route. We take for granted nowadays that three, maybe four is an interesting conversation, but basically there's no such thing as a Hebrew term, as a Hebrew shoresh, that has less than three letters. This was a matter of vociferous debate, I'm sure you'll be surprised to hear. Rashi al-HaTorah takes for granted that there can be a two-letter root. Many of the common wisdom at that time was probably aligned with that. I think more people assumed that was at least a possibility, but this was a raging debate in Sephardic and Ashkenazic grammarian circles. Ibn Janach cinched the debate, essentially, and is widely credited for the one having proved this. Now, to prove that there's no such thing as a two-letter root, right, is a big undertaking. Okay, so you gotta be first rate to take this on, and he did, and he's widely credited therefore with proving. People have discussed it and theorized back and forth, but is having really clinched this argument in favor of the three-letter root or the trilateral root camp. That's Ibn Janach. Okay, now we come to Chasda ibn Shapur. So we're jumping a little bit back. So he's living. He's born around 915. He passes sometime between 970 and 990. We really don't know for sure. Chasda ibn Shapur is certainly a scholar, philosopher, Talmudist, halachist, poet, and so on and so forth. So he's got that whole Renaissance man thing going, but he eventually is best known really for his position in the government. He begins and continues as the physician for the caliph at that time, and he ultimately, although formally he does not adopt this position, or he's not sort of promoted to this position in a titular sense, he becomes in effect the vizier, the foreign minister for the caliph. He is an extremely close confidant, the most trusted advisor probably to the caliph at that time, and he's also what we would call a frum Jew. It's probably not a term that they would have used. Just guessing. Okay, so still in Rav Chaim of Elijah mode. He defends and acts certainly in the interests of the government. He is in charge of the port, for example. He is essentially, behind the scenes at least, probably the most influential minister in regard to peace treaties that the caliph makes with surrounding kingdoms. And he also serves as the emissary and the representative of the Jewish community. So he occupies the classic position, the age-old Jewish position of being a court Jew. Right? Court Jews have a long and rich and varied history in medieval Jewish history in particular, but of course other times as well, going all the way back to Yosef HaTzadik. He actually has a roughly analogous sort of role in the government. That's obviously simplified. It's not exactly the same, but he's interacting with other kingdoms, with other people, including at times of crisis. There's a long history of this. So whether it's Yosef, whether it's Nehemiah is certainly another example, and we find this throughout medieval Jewish history as well. Chasda ibn Shapur is one of the most outstanding of these. Perhaps his greatest claim to fame, certainly not at that time, but in the Jewish imagination, he undertook a series of correspondences with all sorts of interesting people, but best known to me, most intriguing, I think to most people most intriguing, is his famed letter to the Khazars. Letter to the Khazars. So, right, which of course is then enshrined in Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's work, the Khuzari. There's a reference to the Khazar king. Now, this was a myth. I shouldn't say myth. This was a legend or a series of rumors that had begun to circulate at this time that there was some kingdom off in the Far East that had, the king had experimented with different religions and had adopted Judaism as the right one. Ibn Shafrut was skeptical about this. It's, you know, I'm going to send some letter, and to whom am I going to send it? But he becomes curious. His interest is piqued. He tries to send it with one merchant of some sort. Apparently, it doesn't seem to work out. But then there are a number of merchants who come back from the Far East, and they tell him that there is indeed such a king, and there is such a kingdom, and they have adopted Judaism as their official state religion. He says, this is too good to be true. And so he sends this letter together with these emissaries. I have it for you right here. Okay. I have his letter, and perhaps even more interesting, I have the response. All right, so here we go. This is widely available on the internet as well. Okay. Not that small. Okay. Chasai's letter to King Joseph, okay, which is the name of that king. Presumably not his... Presumably not his... his name by birth. King Joseph, I mean. I, Chastai, son of Isaac, son of Ezra, belonging, so this Rechasai Ibn Shapur's letter, belonging to the exiled Jews of Jerusalem and Sfarad, a servant of my lord the king, bow to the earth before him and prostrate myself towards the abode of your majesty from a distant land. Mm-hmm. Right, so he's got, right? He knows exactly how to do it, right? He's got all the diplomatic lingo down to a science. I rejoice in your tranquility. You see, he could probably do this in the middle of his sleep. I rejoice in your tranquility and magnificence and stretch forth my hands to God in heaven, that he may prolong your reign in Israel. Praise be to the beneficent God for his mercy toward me, king of the earth, to whom his Abd al-Rahman, who was the caliph at that time, magnificence and power are known. Bring gifts to him, conciliating his favor by costly presents, such as the king of the Franks, the king of the Gebalim, who are Germans. Remember, Germany was not a unified country at that time. Germany for many, 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 many years, until much of the 19th century, was really a series of smaller kingdoms. That's why in southern Germany, different parts of Germany, you have completely different dialects and cultures and beer festivals and all sorts of things. Arayom Hazeh. Because it was originally quite distinct, carved up. King Constantinople and others, all their gifts passed through my hands. I am charged with making gifts in return. The brackets are just an sort of commentary that's added later on. It's not the original letter. Let my lips express praise to the God of heaven, who so far extends his loving kindness towards me without any merit of my own, but in the fullness of his mercies. I always ask the ambassadors of these monarchs who bring gifts about our brethren, the Israelites, whenever he receives some sort of gift from, right, some exotic kingdom from over the seas, he asks them about essentially the 10 tribes, right, which is of course how the story of the Khazars became famous, this legend of the 10 tribes who were, right, often the Simbatyo, right, the river that ran 6 days a week, but of course rested on Shabbos and so on. Right, the remnants of, by the way, in the Middle Ages, from time to time, you have these people who that's what they did. It's not just some sort of myth. They actually traveled to the Far East with the goal of discovering the 10 tribes. We have historical records of it, of these people who wandered from community to community. Sometimes they claimed that they were the Messiah. Sometimes they came with halachic traditions that were completely different than anything that had been known prior. If you take a look at the Mordechai, who's an Ashkenazic commentary in the back of Masechet Chulin, the very beginning, he quotes this exotic personality known as Eldad Hadani. Eldad Hadani, who claims that he's from the tribe of Dan, from the 10 lost tribes, and he comes with all sorts of new traditions about, and stringencies about the laws of Shechita. And then all the later commentaries try to figure out, like, what do I do with this? Like, is this real? Is this not real? Is this a tradition from the lost tribes? Is this just some guy who's making things up as he goes along to say it kindly? You know, how do we grapple with this? These kinds of things? It was a world where knowledge was at once widespread in terms of philosophical endeavor and so on, but in terms of things like geography or what was out there, in a sense, right, they were very limited in their knowledge, and so all sorts of interesting legends could crop up and had significant influence. So he says, I would always ask whoever would come delivering these gifts, I would always ask them about the lost Jews, about our brethren the Israelites, the remnant of the captivity, whether they have heard anything concerning the deliverance of those who have languished in bondage and have found no rest. At length, mercantile emissaries of Khorasan, right, a land southeast of the Caspian Sea, told me that there is a kingdom of Judah which is called Alcazar. But I did not believe these words, so I thought they told me such things to procure my goodwill and favor. He was, after all, not just a regular Joe. He was an influential person. So they figured, we'll get on his good side, we'll get on the caliph's as well. I was therefore wondering till the ambassadors of Constantinople came between 944-949 with presents and a letter from their king to our king, and I interrogated them concerning this matter. They answered me, it is quite true, and the name of that kingdom is Alcazar. It is 15 days' journey by sea from Constantinople, but by land many nations intervene between us. The name of the king now reigning is Joseph. Ships sometimes come from their country to ours, bringing fish, skins, and wares of every kind. The men are our confederates and are honored by us. There is communication between us by embassies and mutual gifts. They are very powerful. They maintain numerous armies with which they occasionally engage in expeditions. When I heard this report, I was encouraged. My hands were strengthened. My hope is confirmed. Thereupon, I bowed down and adored the God of Heaven. It's a lot of explanation in context of Christian theology. I pray for the health of my Lord the King, of his family, and of his house, and that his throne may be established forever. Let his days and his son's days be prolonged in the midst of Israel. Okay, so that's Kasta. He gets a reply from the king, flesh and blood. Historians' consensus, this is an authentic letter from a real king, of the real Khazars, named Joseph. Okay. That is a good question. I think they were preserved. I'm trying to think. I'm not certain. Okay, I know where to find out, but I'm not certain offhand. Okay, so what's the reply? The letter of Joseph, the king, son of Aaron the king, the Turk. May his creator preserve him. Right, remember he was a convert. May his creator preserve him to the head of the assembly, Chastai, the son of Isaac, son of Ezra. I wish to inform you that your beautifully phrased letter was given to us by Isaac, son of Eliezer, Jew of the land of Germany, who had traveled with it, who served as the mailman in essence. You made us happy, and we were delighted with your understanding and wisdom. Let us therefore renew diplomatic relations that once obtained between our fathers. Let us transmit this heritage to our children. You ask us also in your epistle, of what people, of what family, and of what tribe are you? Know that we are descended from Japhet. From Japhet. Now, Japhet. Right, now this is not necessarily historical, but that was the start, that was their self-understanding. Okay, that's what they thought, through his son, Togarma. Okay, who's the, in Jewish literature, Togarma is the father of all the Turks. I found in the genealogical books of my ancestors that Togarma had 10 sons. These are their names. The eldest was Ujur, the second Taurus, the third Avar, the fourth Uaz, however it's pronounced, the first Bizal, the sixth Tarna, the seventh Khazar, the eighth Januar, the ninth Bulgar, and the tenth Sawir. I'm a descendant of Khazar, the seventh son. I have a record that although our fathers were few in number, the Holy One, blessed be He. And by the way, this is the notion of historical narrative. Now, this is not historical from our perspective, but this is their self-understanding, which made all the difference for them. Gave them strength, power, and might, so that they were able to carry on war after war with many nations who were more powerful and numerous than they. By the help of God, they drove them out and took possession of their country. Upon some of them, they have imposed labor, forced labor, even to this very day. The land in which I now live was formerly occupied by the Bulgarians. Our ancestors, the Khazars, came and fought with them, and although these Bulgarians were as numerous as the sand on the shores of the sea, they could not withstand the Khazars. They left their country, fled, while the Khazars pursued them as far up as the Danube River. Up to this very day, the Bulgars camp along the Danube and are close to Constantinople. The Khazars has occupied their lands up till now. Okay. Then we cut to the chase, sort of. So how did all of this happen? After this, several generations passed, and a certain king arose whose name was Bulan. He was a wise and God-fearing man, trusting his creator with all his heart. He expelled the wizards and the idolaters from the land and took refuge in the shadow of his wings. After this, his fame was spread broadcast. The king of the Byzantines and the Arabs, who had heard of him, sent their envoys and ambassadors with great riches and many great presents to the king, as well as some of their wise men, with the object of converting him to their own religion. But the king, may his soul be bound up with the bundle of life, with his Lord, his God being wise, sent for a learned Israelite. And again, this piece of it, or some kernel of this, is considered to be historically truthful. Again, the whole story, not necessarily, but the idea that there was such a king who really wrote, and he wrote this letter, and he's saying that we are Jewish. This is exactly what he reported to Chastai. Each of them refuted, however, the arguments of his opponents so that they could not agree. When the king saw this, he said to them, "Go home, but return to me on the third day." What does this sound like? Anyone familiar? This is exactly the story that's recorded in the introduction to the Kuzari. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi clearly had this letter, knew about this. He reproduced this. This is the literary frame for the Kuzari. Now, the Kuzari is a fictional work. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi does not mean it historically, much as Plato's dialogues were not historical. It was a literary convention. But it comes straight from this letter. This is it. This is where he got it from. This is the tradition. This is a real letter that he got. So what Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi does is he takes the legend of the Khazars and he imagines that this was the conversation. So first, right, so the Christian came and the Muslim came and the Aristotelian philosopher came. They all came and they all tried to convince the king. And he rejects them one after another. And the Jewish scholar comes and they have five volumes, essentially, or five long chapters of dialogue, which then becomes the Kuzari. So it's an imagined conversation, but it comes straight from here. On the third day, he called all the sages together and said to them, speak and argue with one another. Make clear to me which is the best religion. It's already a little bit different than the way the Kuzari works. They began to dispute with one another without arriving at any results, till the king said to the Christian priest, what do you think of the religion of the Jews and the Muslims? Which is to be preferred? The priest answered, the religion of the Israelites is better than that of the Muslims. The king then said, asked the Qadi, what do you say? Is the religion of the Israelites or that of the Christians preferable? The Qadi answered, right, says the Muslim, the religion of the Israelites is preferable. And this is sort of the notion that Islam and Christianity are drawn from, or each one respectively, are drawn from Jewish roots. So the most basic common denominator of all three is, of course, Judaism. So upon this, the king said, if this is so, you both have admitted with your own mouths that the religion of the Israelites is better. Wherefore, trusting in the mercies of God and the power of the Almighty, I choose the religion of Israel, that is the religion of Abraham. If that God in whom I trust, and the shadow of whose wings I find refuge will aid me, and give me without labor the money, the gold, and the silver which you have promised me. As for you all, go now in peace to your land. And then after this, he becomes successful, and so on and so forth. And then at the end, in the second to last paragraph, after the days of Gulan, there arose one of his descendants, a king of Avadia by name, who reorganized the kingdom and established the Jewish religion properly and correctly. He built synagogues, yeshivot, brought in Jewish scholars, rewarded them with gold and silver. They explained to him the Bible, Mishnah, Talmud, and the order of divine services. The king was a man who revered and loved the Torah as one of the true servants of God. May the divine spirit give him rest, and so on and so forth, until him. And Joseph is the one who is now serving as the king, but this is his sort of his own history. And he concludes, may be the gracious will of him who appoints all kings that the throne of my kingdom shall endure to all eternity. And I'll give you more. But this is, I think you get the basic idea. And then he concludes, you mentioned in your letter that you don't see my face. I also would very much like to see the pleasant countenance, the rare beauty of your wisdom and greatness. Chastai's reputation was certainly well known. Would that were according to your, or certainly in the Islamic world, if it were granted me to be associated with you and to behold your honored, charming, and pleasant countenance, then you would be my father and I your son. I mean, we don't write this way anymore. It's beautiful. According to your command, would all my people be ruled, and according to your order and discreet counsel, would I conduct all my affairs. Farewell. I don't know if that's actually, he meant it that way, but I think it's sort of the way that you communicate respectfully. And this is a real primary document. I don't claim, and the historians don't claim, that all this is historical in the sense that his report is rooted in historical scholarship. It's his self-understanding, as we've discussed, in terms of how memory works, etc. But this was the real letter that was written by the real King Joseph, who really understood his history to be this way, and really had a Jewish kingdom of some sort. This is pretty much all we know. And it's just enough for it to be something that's real, that's substantial, that's historically rooted, and just little enough for it to be the stuff of imaginations run wild, right? There's a reason that the ten tribes and the Khazars and all of this is the stuff of Jewish myth for 1,000 years. So this is really remarkable, and I think it also speaks to I think part of its survival and its popularity. Well, let me throw it up into you. What's the sense of, why is this something that's so well known, that's so oft repeated in the Jewish community?
That's a good question.
It's an amazing story.
It's the primacy of the Jewish religion.
Good. In what context?
It's the true religion.
Okay. Even if we're being well respected, relatively speaking, in the golden age of Spain,
right.
We are, right? We're not quote unquote winning. We don't have our own sovereignty. We don't have sovereignty. We don't have control, quote unquote. Christians and Muslims outstrip the Jewish community with regard to demographics, with regard to influence, with regard to everything, pretty much. And so the notion, and especially in Christian communities later on, but even in this Islamic community, the notion that there's some far-flung community that looked at all of these religions and came out with the conclusion that Judaism is true and the entire kingdom converted to Judaism, it restores a sense of self-confidence. Mm-hmm. There's a sense of vindication in that, which is, and then imagine telling that story to your children as they grow up as a minority and a majority, if not hostile, at times hostile, but at times just a majority culture that's foreign or that doesn't accept really ultimately the theological underpinnings of our faith, even if they engage with us and even if they treat us with relative respect and so on. So there's a sense of sort of self-confidence that comes with repeating this story, and so it fulfills a very powerful psychological need for the Jewish community at this time. Awesome.
Yes.
Okay. Good. Let's do one or two more and then we'll wrap up. Any thoughts about that, though?
Interesting.
Yeah, really.
Okay. Process.
Yeah. You mentioned just reading.
Yeah, right. Right. I'm going to take out the shot. Yeah.
You don't know to what extent it's based in historical quote unquote fact,
right.
Or you know whether there was any basis for it. So it's interesting to see that the based on
again the self.
I was always taught the opposite, that there was none.
Right.
You know, specifically that this is just a wonderful, you know, it's fantasy. You know, like it's like this,
like we were saying,
yeah,
which it is also,
yeah.
which it is, but. Those two, in a sense, that strengthens
survival.
It.
Yeah, right.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's different, but it's, again, it's a lot of these stories in terms of using these sort of seemingly outlandish but really remarkable narratives to really bolster a sense of identity in our narrative and our, right? And especially in a minority culture, it becomes particularly important and compelling. Cool. Okay. Next. Shul Hanagid. We'll just do one or two more and then we're going to pause for today.
It was a street named after him.
Okay. He has what? A street named after him? That's right. Okay. We'll get there. Shul Hanagid. We're not going to do too much, but I'll mention him and his son. He's also known at that time as Shmuel Ibn Nagrela. Nagrela, that was the original name. Nagrella. Hanagid, again, the vizier. I think he occupied this position formally for the caliph at the time. Also, one of the most famous court Jews, poet, philosopher, and so on and so forth. I forgot to mention, by the way, Chassid ibn Shapir was of... I did mention. I said he was a physician,
yeah.
Right? I guess that was a Stam, famous Jewish personality as a doctor. okay. Hanagid... also famous, I'm not going to add so much biographically with regard to him, but his position is inherited by his son. Son's first name, Yosef Hanagid. But his son, unfortunately, is involved in the massacres of 1066. We had mentioned that although this was a relatively benign period, it was punctuated at certain key moments by violence. This takes place in Granada. And it precipitates a crisis of sorts, although I think overall the Jewish self-understanding was to see it as a blip on the radar screen, which it probably was until some other, relatively speaking, more radical sects rose to power. But that that was, so again, here you have a very complicated scenario. You have a Jew who has risen to the highest levels of government. His son is able to do the same, and yet that very same son is, if not directly targeted, is murdered as part of a massacre of Jews. And by the way, his son's prominence and his own prominence was not something that was entirely comfortable for the Islamic community at that time. The notion that Jews sort of had a place, but they had to, you know, as long as they kept to their place, and it could be a relatively high station compared to, again, other opportunities available to Jews and other minorities during the Middle Ages, but as long as they kept to those places, everything was fine. When they, quote-unquote, overstepped, that's where things became a little bit more sensitive, where it became theologically challenging or uncomfortable. But there was a Jew in such a high position of power, after all, maybe he's a people of the book, he's a monotheist as well, right? But he's not what we call Dara al-Islam, he's not of the house of Islam, and isn't this overreaching? So again, you have sort of these tensions where this is, in many respects, we call it a golden age, I think rightfully so, but it's not entirely good. It's not just completely random that there are these waves of mob violence or anything like that, but really it's part of this delicate balance where the Jewish community was accepted largely and meaningfully to a point, and if you went beyond that point, it became a little bit more complicated, unfortunately, with violent repercussions at times. Okay. I'm going to quickly review this is number 6 already for today, and then I'll mention the next thinker that we'll do, but we'll give him, he'll require a little bit more time, so we'll do that hopefully beginning next week. So personality number 6 for today, Moshe Ibn Ezra, not to be confused with Ibn Ezra or Rabbi Abraham Ibn Ezra. Moshe Ibn Ezra, it lives from approximately 1055 to 1138. He's a philosopher. He is a poet. We have many of his poems have survived. Many of Avram Ibn Ezra's poems have survived as well, as we'll get to. Moshe Ibn Ezra, however, of all of his contributions, is best known as a patriot, which is really very interesting. Even though he's an intellectual, certainly in his own right, and writes beautiful poetry and so on, he's particularly the patron of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, whom Rabbi Yehuda Halevi actually writes about in his own poetry, I believe. And this is not uncommon. There are Jews who clearly are very wealthy at this time. And there is sort of a, and you have this mirrored in the Islamic community, contemporary Islamic community at that time. You have individuals who rise to positions. They are bankers. They rise to positions of financial prominence. Right. And they in turn support other people who are engaging this thing. It's like the arts. It's really, it's not like the arts. It is the arts. But it's outstanding rabbis who are scholars in their own right, who are from some of the most storied families in the Jewish community at that time, who then take that upon themselves. And they're involved sometimes in financing non-Jewish thinkers, but there's a sense of commitment to the Jewish community in particular. The notion of a Jewish patron for the arts is very familiar to us. The notion of a Jewish patron for the Jewish arts, I think less so. But that's not something that stopped them. There was a sense that it was not at all inconsistent for them to specifically or especially support their fellow Jews who were contributing, in any case, to the overall culture. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi writes some of his most famous songs and poetry that we know about are certainly Jewish in nature, there's no question, Zionist and so on and so forth. But Rabbi Yehuda Halevi also writes much more broadly in things that would be termed quote-unquote secular poems, at least by people at that time anyway. We might see them as religious in the broader sense of the term, but would have been recognized at that time or as non-Jewish, not particularly Jewish poetry as well. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was well-regarded. Moshe Ibn Ezra, so no problem supporting Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and others at that time. So to me, it's fascinating that someone who was from such a prestigious family and outstanding personality and so accomplished, yet best well-known as someone who in turn enabled others who eclipsed him in their fame and in their contributions to then in turn be successful on their own, which I think is something worth thinking about as well. Okay, next person I'm going to have to look at, but he's going to take a little bit more time. So I'm going to leave him aside for this week. We'll circle back. Is Rabbeinu Bachya ibn Pakude. Rabbeinu Bachya, by the way, it's not to be confused with another person who sounds similar, Rabbeinu Bachaye, who was a little bit of a later student of Ramban. We're going to get to as well, if briefly. This is Rabbeinu Bachya, who was 11th century, and his outstanding work is the Chovot Halvavot. The Chovot Halvavot is a Neoplatonist oriented work written approximately the year 1040, so around the year of Rashi's birth. And Rabbeinu Bachya becomes one of the most influential thinkers in all of Jewish history. We'll hopefully read a little bit from his introduction and some of his, I'll take a few excerpts as well. It's a good opportunity for me to read up on my Rabbeinu Bachya, really one of the most decisive works or influential works that we have. One of the things we'll have to look at it as we examine these works is to see what people read now and what people read then, which is really very interesting. There are many of these classic works that are used sort of in very specific kinds of ways in modern yeshivot and so on. Whereas, so for example, in his cases, we'll see the focus on the ethics, but not necessarily in the metaphysics or the philosophical inquiry or the Neoplatonism, you know, that which is unfamiliar or not in vogue anymore, sort of left aside and ignored. You jump straight to the concepts of bitachon, etc., that we're familiar with, which is not intellectually dishonest per se, but I think also lacks a certain sense of the richness of the work. And sometimes you sort of, I think sometimes in Shiva what happens because of that is like, oh, it was Rabbeinu Bachya. I mean, sort of assume that he was like the equivalent of a Lithuanian 19th century rabbinic thinker who focused on Musar and so wrote about things like bitachon and so on, which it's true that he wrote about topics like that, but it's also true that his larger ovior was really quite different from a 19th century Lithuanian Musarist, like we saw Salanter, and yet people who are studying Musar are looking at things like the Chovos HaVavos in context of the larger Musar movement, not because they think that historically it was associated with that movement, but because there are certain sections that are very influential and very important in Rabbeinu Bachya, which really go to those topics of ethics and Musar, etc. So I think it's very interesting when we see it in historical context to see the larger work, I think gives a sort of a richer understanding. And I think it's just very interesting that very often we sort of see either personalities in contemporary circles sometimes, in the yeshiva world sometimes, sort of these personalities shorn of their larger philosophy or their larger life's works. And I think one of the benefits of doing it in a historical sense is that we sort of get more holistic contextual view as to who these personalities really were. So next week we have Rabbeinu Bachya, who will take some of our time, and Ibn Ezra as well. That is going to be great. We'll do some excerpts from each of them. We'll take a look at some of their writings, their poetry. Ibn Ezra had a devilish sense of humor, so we'll get some insight into that as well.